NPR News, Moscow.
President Obama setting the stage for Thanksgiving today by upholding a White House tradition stretching back several administrations.
Today I have the awesome responsibility of granting a presidential pardon to a pair of turkeys. Now, for the record, let me say that it feels pretty good to stop at least one shellacking this November.
With that, the president granted an official pardon to a turkey named Apple and its sidekick Cider. They'll be taken to George Washington's estate at Mount Vernon in Virginia, just outside the nation's capital, where they'll live out their days far from any ovens or dinner tables. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment with The Pillars of the Earth, the 8-part miniseries based on the novel by Ken Follett, available on Blu-ray and DVD.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, I'm Jeff Bossert.
I'm Tom Rogers.
I'm Celeste Quinn.
And I'm David Inge. You listen to us on WILL Radio and TV, and now we want to listen to you. Every month, we're out in the community having conversations about your hopes and challenges. What we hear impacts the programs we produce and the content we create. If you'd like us to have a community conversation in your town, give us a call at 217-333-7300 or email willconnect@illinois.edu. Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Both shows today come from the Focus Archives, both of them programs we first broadcast in August. In the second hour, Celeste Quinn talked with Rosalind Cartwright, author of The 24-Hour Mind. It's about sleep and what happens in the brain when we sleep. But in this first hour, we will talk, or you will hear me talk, with Connie Shapiro. She's professor of family studies at the U of I. We talked back in August on the 24th about her book, What to Expect When You're Not Expecting. So keep in mind, this morning, both hours will not be taking calls. For some couples, getting pregnant seems to require no effort at all. But for others, weeks and months of trying only leads to feelings of loneliness and frustration and sadness. Our guest for this hour of Focus, Constance Shapiro, says that while infertility is a journey that is different for every person, it has some well-traveled pathways. And it was in an effort to try to help people who are on that path that she wrote a book that we'll be talking about this morning. And the title of her book is When You're Not Expecting, An Infertility Survival Guide. I think that her idea was that perhaps we have a good amount of information that has to do with the medical aspects of infertility, but she is trying to get at something that's really different, and it's something that she tries to get at with her writing and speaking and consulting work, and that is all of the emotional issues that are associated with infertility. The book is out now. It's published by Wiley, so if you're interested, you certainly should take a look at it. Our guest, Constance Shapiro, is a therapist. She's a university professor, consultant, public speaker. She's founding member of the Central New York chapter of Resolve, which is a national organization that provides support to people who are experiencing infertility. She here is a professor of family studies and social work at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. And pleased to have you in the studio.
Thank you, David.
Thanks. You know, I have to admit that I misspoke. I was talking just before the news about the program, and I gave the title of your book, and I'm afraid in my head I had the title of this very well-known, big, best-selling book that's for people who are pregnant. And the title of the book is What to Expect When You're Expecting. Probably people who are listening to us have read the book. And clearly that's what you were playing off of with the title of your book, When You're Not Expecting. Is it the case you think that there's a big gulf there in the literature for people who are dealing with infertility?
Well, certainly most of the books on the bookshelves these days are ones that focus on the medical aspects of infertility. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, those need to be updated quite regularly because there are a number of new advances in medicine that give hope to a number of couples. So the emotional impact of infertility, which is really timeless, it is the same for couples 15 years ago as it is for couples now, which is an immense feeling of loneliness, sometimes a feeling of stigma, feeling as though you don't want to share this particular particular sadness with others because it seems as if it should be private. And that doesn't appear on the bookshelves very often. So I hoped, after having written two books on infertility for academic audiences, with my clients saying to me, won't you please write a book for us, I decided to write a book with my clients' voices talking about the emotional impact of infertility and also talking about the ways in which they had triumphed emotionally over the sadnesses that they had faced as they were trying to conceive or as they faced pregnancy losses.
Yeah. I think you touch on something there that I think is very important. I know that it's a particular interest, and I'm sure that for people who are experiencing infertility, it's a big question, and that is who to share the information with and when.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very difficult thing. People, I'm sure, have understandable reasons for not wanting to share with family, with friends. And yet I think I'm sure you would make the argument that says there comes a time and a place where actually that's a good thing to do.
Yes. Let me backtrack just a little bit because I'd like to define infertility for the listeners since it's a term that may have many impressions, but I, for these purposes, would like to be as clear as I can. So infertility for heterosexual couples consists of the couple trying for at least 1 year with unprotected intercourse to conceive. There is another group of people who are trying to conceive, same-sex couples, who are considered to have what's called social factor infertility. And also falling in this group is single women who wish to become pregnant by choice. So those particular groups are going to – the social factor infertility groups are going to need to find a donor of eggs or sperm to make it possible for them to conceive. And because they already live with a certain amount of stigma based upon their choice of partner or the choice to decide to become a single parent, there's even more apprehension on their part to sharing this news. And lastly is a group of people who have what's called secondary infertility. Secondary infertility means they have had one child or perhaps more than one but are now experiencing difficulty conceiving. So with all of those groups, there is a different reason for being cautious about sharing the news. And what I say in the book is that it becomes a very heavy burden for the couple to bear between the two of them. Ultimately, they are going to need and want to reach out to someone. It may be to family, if family are understanding. It may be to clergy. It may be finding a support person, such as a counselor. It may be sharing information in the office so that when there are baby showers happening, people will understand that for a person in the office who's infertile, it's emotionally painful to attend. So I think everyone comes in their own time to a decision about with whom to share and how to do that. But it is helpful not to bear that burden on your own shoulders or only with your partner and yourself.
Yeah. For individuals who are experiencing infertility, they want to conceive. If they're working with a physician, that person presumably is dealing with all the medical stuff. How do you think about the need for the possible benefits of having a different kind of counselor, somebody like you, for example, that would help people to talk about the emotional part of the experience?
Well, I think certainly if they are working with an infertility specialist who is dealing with the unique aspects of helping them to become pregnant, they will find that their conversations with that physician deal only around the physical issues that they're experiencing. So when they realize that they, the couple, are having a lot of anxiety, a lot of loneliness, a lot of tension, and are functioning less well in their lives with perhaps depression coming in, women do not want to take antidepressants when they're trying to get pregnant. Their doctors don't want them to, and they don't want to. So at a time when anxiety and depression tends to be easy to have happen with infertility, seeking a counselor is a very smart thing to do. I think we're all ready to go to physicians for our medical problems. Sometimes we are a little less ready to go to counselors for our emotional tensions.
Yeah. As you've mentioned, the medical definition, and it also I think does change depending on the age of the people that you're talking to. But if you say you have a young couple, that the medical definition of infertility is trying to get pregnant without using any contraception for an entire year. So that's kind of a long time. And I don't know at what point most people start to feel sort of frustrated or sort of feel that, you know, say they're having unprotected intercourse for 3 months or 4 months or 5 months, they might think that certainly should be enough time. So I don't know at what point people actually start to think that they might want to have a consultation with some kind of physician. I assume that people probably also start with maybe their basic doctor, family care doctor, or possibly women who might, if they have a regular relationship with a gynecologist, maybe they start with that person. Is there some reason to, if you think that's what's going on, to right away seek out somebody who is a specialist to deal with infertility?
Certainly, some men and some women may know that there have been some reproductive problems in their lives, or that in terms of medications that mothers have taken when they were pregnant with a daughter, that there may be problems. So if there is already an awareness of possible difficulties, it is absolutely worth it to go straight to an infertility specialist. Some insurance companies will not cover the costs of this until a couple has tried for 1 year. So there are all sorts of reasons that it behooves one to keep a good record of having tried and having begun to discuss this with your physician as soon as you begin trying, so that everyone is aware that you're maximizing the possibility of intercourse at the time of the woman's ovulation and that you are doing everything you can during that first year. You're right that youngest couples are most likely to be fertile, that women beginning in their mid-30s are going to be less fertile. So for women in their mid-30s, they usually are asking that those women after 6 months identify a specialist with whom they can work.
Mm. Now, I don't know that we want to get too much into the medical stuff, because that's a different issue. But I guess I do wonder whether, as part of, say, your planning for pregnancy, if you're fortunate enough to have a physician, that it would be worth people having a kind of a conversation to say, well, just starting right off, are there some particularly easy things? We're not talking about big medical interventions, but any things that one would suggest to start that would make it more likely that you would conceive?
Well, some research has just been released in an article in New York Times last week indicating that for healthy women who stop birth control, the ones who most quickly conceive have the least amount of stress hormones in their saliva. So what this actually suggests strongly is that women should, as much as possible, reduce the amount of stress that they experience, whether they do this through meditation, through mindful breathing, through yoga, maybe through counseling. And that hopefully will enhance the earliness of conception. So that finding actually is very important, and I think something that women can pay attention to quite quickly. For males, there is always the advice of try to keep the testicles at room temperature, so don't wear tight pants, don't ride bicycles frequently. Yeah. So those kinds of things are also useful. We do need to remember that it isn't only the woman who will contribute to the infertility. 40% of the contributing factors come from women, 40% of them come from men, and the remaining 20% are shared between the man and the woman if it's a heterosexual relationship.
Yeah, I would imagine that gets another issue that I'm sure that if couples are having a difficult time conceiving, that it would be natural, I suppose, for them to want to know, all right, who's the problem here? And, you know, maybe there might be some reluctance for one or the other of the couple to say, well, looks like I'm the problem. And I don't know if that is true or if it's, you know, to what extent the issue of what the problem is becomes an issue between the two people.
Well, interestingly, obviously, it's going to be important for the physician to know which of the two persons must be treated. So it does become an open issue between the two of them. What most research has shown is that, in fact, it is the woman who takes the worry upon herself and has the emotional reaction to her inability to become pregnant, even if it is that her husband's sperm are contributing to the difficulty in that pregnancy. So when I have met with infertile people, I always ask that the couple come together for the first three sessions. Then after that, we have some decisions about whether and who would benefit most from continuing to come and see me.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because I'm sure since it's the woman who becomes pregnant that so much focus is on her, and I suppose that she then puts that focus on herself. And as you've said, what you're saying is that for kind of physical workup, kind of checkup to see what's going on, it's important that both, I mean, if we're talking about a man and a woman here, a heterosexual couple, that you get a checkup on both parties sort of to see what's going on, right. And that that the guy in the relationship is a part of the whole deal, and it's not just about the woman. So whether you're talking about physical workup or you're talking about counseling, what you're saying is that both people have to be involved equally.
Yes, absolutely.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Constance Shapiro. She's professor of family studies and social work here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's a therapist, consultant, public speaker, and is very interested in the study of infertility and particularly the emotional impact that it has on individuals and couples. And that is the subject of her book, When You're Not Expecting, an Infertility Survival Guide. It's published by Wiley. It's a paperback book and not terribly expensive. And if you'd like to get some information about that, this would be a good place to go. People have questions, you can call. Maybe people have experiences they'd want to tell us about. They can do that too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm sure that this is the kind of thing that can, you talk about the importance of not being highly stressed, that really helps. Well, I'm sure this is the kind of thing that can be a source of stress and particularly can be a difficult and a divisive issue for couples. This, I'm sure, can be a real tough thing in your relationship, particularly if you really want to have children, if you're really committed to that idea of having children.
Yes, and I think one of the things that I have found is that when I begin to see a couple, it is usually the woman who has called me. It is usually she and her husband who come and sit down, and immediately she will say, I think I'm going crazy. So it is often the woman who is the spokesperson for the couple. And if it's a same-sex couple, then that tends to be a little bit more on equal partner participation. Mm-hmm. What I find is that women tend to have a wish to express their emotions about this, both in counseling sessions with me, but also with their friends and with their family. Men tend to be uncomfortable about their partner's emotional tearfulness, sadness, bloodshot eyes, and don't always know how to offer comfort. So one of the first things that I do both in my book and also in counseling sessions is to have the woman talk with her partner about how he can be most comforting to her. And he's often very surprised that she doesn't get comforted by his making jokes, by his trying to divert the topic to something else, and that, in fact, for her to be held and cuddled and that they can spend some time talking about this is actually what would work best for her. So sometimes it's simply an opportunity for the man and woman to talk in ways that help both of them feel that they share the sadness and that they share responsibility for trying to figure out how they're going to seek help, both medically and emotionally.
Mm. You know, I would imagine that one of the cases where this would be even more difficult and perhaps become more divisive is if one of the people is actually kind of ambivalent about the idea of having children. Maybe one of them just intensely, really, really wants to be a parent. And the other's attitude is, well, okay. I mean, that because that's something you really want, we'll do that. And I'm perfectly fine with that. But then that, and I guess I'm speaking like a guy, I could imagine the person thinking, well, yes, it would be nice to have children. Yes, I know my partner thinks it's important. But to me, it's not that important. So somehow I don't experience the same sense of loss and frustration, obviously, my partner does, because to be honest, I would have to say this was not on the top of my life list, being a parent.
Yes, that does happen, and it sometimes occurs because the male may have had a previous marriage, may have had children already, may have felt that his parenting responsibilities have been experienced, may still be parenting his children on a part-time basis. So we sometimes do have circumstances where the male is, for a variety of reasons, less committed, less enthusiastic about parenthood. So we bring that to the table for some discussion. You know, what is it that you have invested in the success of your wife conceiving? Often the answer is, I want her to be happy. It isn't always that I want us to be parents. But if she could become pregnant, he will say, then her sadness will disappear. She'll get to be back to my wife again because I feel like I've lost her to this sadness. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we aren't only talking about children. We are also talking about the relationship that has gone astray.
Mm. I wonder how you talk to people about what infertility does to your sex life. because I'm sure that if there's anything that can spoil the pleasure that you take in lovemaking and the spontaneity that you hope would go with it, it's the idea that, you know, you look at your watch and say, oh my gosh, now it's time. Now let's run to the bedroom. You know, when it becomes something that almost starts to feel like a job, or at least it's on some kind of strange schedule, and so much pressure now is put on it. You know, when you think about going from when the big thing is we want to have sex, but we don't want to get pregnant. Now when the thing is it's okay to be pregnant, we want to be pregnant. That's putting an awful lot of pressure on something that really should not have to bear that pressure.
This is true. And I devote an entire chapter in my book to that. The chapter is called Scheduled Sex, When Making Love Becomes Hard Work. Mm-hmm. And I will say that my clients, when I raise the issue with them, which it takes me perhaps one or two sessions to do, their jaws drop to think that I'm even bringing this into the conversation. But 98% of them will say, yes, it's a problem. And we don't know if we want to talk with you about this, but without too much difficulty, they do. And it does become a challenge, I think, for the people for whom it is less of a challenge are those who know that they are not going to conceive through intercourse, those who know that they're dependent upon technology, in vitro fertilization, other forms of technology will be the only way of the woman's becoming pregnant. Mm-hmm. For them, intercourse then can go back to making love. But you're quite right that the tension about we must do it, we must somehow do it right, we must catch the time of the woman's ovulation, has everybody feeling tense and on edge. And we in counseling sessions talk about this. But the fact that I devote an entire chapter of my book also says that I feel that it's important to include in an open way. Mm-hmm. And David, I should go back also to saying that my book is an outcome of having counseled hundreds of couples, and I have taken their voices and put them into each chapter of my book so that it isn't only my voice that talks with the reader. It is actually people who have struggled with infertility, have triumphed over infertility, and so the chapter about scheduled sex mostly is from my clients with their identities very well disguised, mm-hmm. talking about how they confronted, dealt with the impact of disruption of their lovemaking when they were trying to get pregnant.
Well, is there an easy answer to that? I'm sure that it's easy enough for some for an outside person just to say, well, just relax. Just don't worry about that. Concentrate on being with one another and enjoying this wonderful experience, and just don't worry about the other thing. It's really easy for an outsider to do that if you're not the one who is in this relationship who really, really wants to get pregnant.
Yes. Well, I do say to couples that it's important to sort of set the scene. So I say to them the bedroom really should be for sleeping and for lovemaking. No computers, no televisions, no distractions that have to do with calendars for the next day, mm-hmm. that as much as possible when they enter the bedroom, it should be for lovemaking and for sleeping and for relaxing. I don't want them talking about their infertility in the bedroom. I do actually ask them to find a room in the house, a place in the house, which is fair game for where they're going to be talking about their infertility. And I actually also encourage them to limit the amount of time each day that they spend talking about their infertility. So what you and I are actually discussing is the sacredness of the bedroom for lovemaking, mm-hmm. and also being able to put some boundaries around the way that infertility infects all aspects of the married life.
All right. We have a caller, and we'd certainly welcome others. If you'd like to be involved in the conversation, maybe you have a question or maybe you have an experience to relate, that would be great either way. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And also, you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's someone in Charleston to talk with on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I am probably going to throw a wrench into the conversation briefly. But I've been married for 30 years and have two children, grown children, who we adopted. And I guess what I wanted to say is I don't think that all infertile couples feel that it's a struggle to get pregnant and that you triumph over this infertility in some way, because in my own particular situation, in our situation, we decided after 10 years of marriage that we would like to have children, and we tried, but I wouldn't give us an A on our effort, and at one time just had one infertility test, which showed that my husband indeed had high motility, so the sperm were fine, but we didn't try that hard, and one of the intervening factors for us was there were two for me. One, I was diabetic. I still am diabetic, but I was insulin dependent. And to carry a baby would involve incredible selflessness, which I would not characterize myself as being particularly selfless. And the other is I have a horrible genetic history. I mean, every disease known to man is in my family. And after this one test, I realized that having a baby, carrying a baby to full term, included certain possible dangers and consequences. And also, it would be a nice idea to probably nip my genetic history in the bud at this time and not carry on somebody else's diseases or and family history, but didn't have to be mine. And so we went the international adoption route, and we're very happy about it. I cried once in all of this, and it's only because my husband has this wonderful curly red hair, and I would love to have had a curly redheaded kid. But once I got through that, things were fine. And he also, in our 30 years of marriage, I think the best thing he ever said to me was, I didn't marry you for your baby-making capacity. And, you know, so I don't think that all couples struggle necessarily with the concept of infertility. I mean, in terms of the difficulty that you're talking about. And I wish that society would not see that as such a strong value. That children, we value children, but not necessarily the concept of biological children.
I think you make an excellent point, and I very much appreciate your calling in and sharing your own personal story. I think you are an example of somebody who was actually very insightful. You and your husband were very clear with each other about the issues and the dangers of your having a birth child. And in the days when you were adopting, the opportunity for international adoption was, in fact, fairly open. As you may know, it's getting more and more difficult to adopt internationally. And I think that sometimes gets in the way of people being able to view adoption as an easy second option if conceiving is not necessarily medically a good choice. But certainly for you, I'm very happy that you were able to reach that decision with your husband as easily as you did. And I also wish that a number of infertile couples who are struggling emotionally could find a pathway as peaceful as yours has been.
Mm-hmm. And you're right. Yeah, I think it involves a lot of self-talk and understanding of what your goals are and also looking at options and getting family support and friend support is very important also.
Sure.
Because our adopted kids were just taken into the family as though they were biological kids, and things have been really smooth overall. So.
Well, I'm very happy for you and for your family.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the story. Other folks can call in with questions, with stories. Our guest is Constance Shapiro. She is a professor of family studies and social work here at U of I, Urbana-Champaign. She's a therapist. She is a consultant, public speaker, and very interested in the study of infertility and its emotional impact on individuals and couples. And she is the author of the book, When You're Not Expecting, an Infertility Survival Guide, published by Wiley. She also, by the way, has a blog, if you're interested in that. It's at www.connieshapiro.com, and questions are welcome. I appreciate the story of the listener, and I wonder what people have said to you that you've talked with about this, well, you can always adopt thing, because I'm sure that that's, you know, people who are having difficulty conceiving, who really want to have a biological child, that's one of those things that they probably hear a lot. People say to them, oh, it's okay. You can always adopt. And while that's wonderful, it's not exactly the same. And if you're really trying to conceive, you know, maybe that's not the kind of thing that you want to hear.
No, it's not a very reassuring comment, and I'll address it from a couple of different perspectives. One perspective is that the woman is often very much looking forward to the experience of pregnancy, and so adoption doesn't offer that. She may also be looking forward to the experience of nursing, and that is possible with adoption, but it takes a lot of extra effort and medical help. Mm-hmm. So to suggest that adopting a child is a substitute for the satisfaction and joy of pregnancy and nursing does take away that dimension. The other aspect, as I mentioned to our listener, is that international adoptions are becoming more difficult now. Mm-hmm. Many of the countries that were more ready for couples to turn to them, China being one, Russia being another, have now put very clear statements about the age of the adopting parent, about mental health problems that any of the adopting parents may ever have had, about whether either of the adoptive parents has been divorced or in a previous marriage. So there are a number of screening devices being used by international countries in the adoption process that make it much more difficult now than in past years for couples to adopt. I don't say this as a way of discouraging couples, but I do say it as a way of suggesting for anyone who wants to be reassuring and saying mm-hmm. you can always adopt. It is not an easy process. It is something that our caller mentioned in terms of her family having been very supportive of the adoption. Often the grandparents-to-be have their own issues about bringing a child into the family who is adopted, particularly if that child is international and has different skin color or different facial features than the parents who have adopted. Mm-hmm. So adoption is not something that one leaps to quickly. It's a very careful process that the couple needs to discuss between themselves, with their family. And they also need to look at their community and see how receptive their community will be to a child who may come in, internationally in particular, looking different from other kids in the neighborhood, other kids in the school system. And this is particularly true in rural communities. Mm-hmm. So I do realize people try to say things that are comforting when they realize a couple is going through infertility, but encouraging them to adopt is not necessarily going to feel responsive to the person who's hearing these words.
Yeah. I'm sure that if you're experiencing infertility, you're going through this, and again, you're someone who really, really wants to conceive, you really want to have a biological child, that you suddenly realize that parenthood is everywhere all around you.
You walk down the street, you see people walking along with carriages. And it's not just, yeah, I'm sure Mother's Day is an issue. And if there's a baby shower at work, there's an issue. But all around you, you see people, you see children. They're on television. They're in movies. They're in advertising. They're right there in front of you. They're your neighbors. You can't, and I'm sure that if this is something that's just like constantly right in the forefront of your thinking, everywhere you look, it's going to be smacking you in the face. How do you work with people to get them to deal with all of that?
Well, we talk about it because it's different for everyone. It's particularly painful when one member of the couple is in a profession that involves working with children or sometimes working with abused children, so that the issue really is different for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so we acknowledge that that is a problem. Sometimes it's a matter of speaking honestly to one's family members who have many nieces and nephews coming to holiday and family events, to one's neighbor who has an adorable little child, but one that just evokes tears every time you see her, and to be honest with the people in your lives who are most likely to know that you may be needing to pull back a bit. The chapter in my book that deals with this particular thing is called The Club, On the Outside Looking In. And this has to do with what I think of as a club of women, all of whom are very devoted to their pregnancies and their parenting of young children, and with whom conversations are filled with references to pregnancy, childbirth, nursing. Being able to distance oneself from people who simply can't stop talking about this and try to get more in touch with couples who don't have children, with couples who are older and whose children are out of the home, is one way of being able to do this. Another way, actually, is to consider joining a support group of infertile couples, all of whom are going to be talking about how they are coping with this same issue about kids everywhere. I can remember in my infertile days, I avoided an entire part of the mall where there was a maternity shop because I couldn't bring myself to walk past the mannequins in the windows with these wonderful maternity clothes that I just wanted more than anything to buy. So it's kids, it's in your office, it's everywhere. And being able to find ways of getting in touch with nature, of finding friends who are less involved with always talking about their little ones, their kids, is about the best one can hope for.
Yeah. And what about Mother's Day? You just lock yourself in the house and turn off the television for a couple of days?
Well, you don't go out to restaurants because that's what everybody is celebrating that day. And many people are careful about going to their places of worship on Mother's Day, mm-hmm. because there is a pattern in this country of the religious leader offering sometimes flowers to women in the congregation who are mothers, corsages, sometimes asking all of the mothers in the congregation to stand to be recognized. And it's at that time that the people I'm counseling leave. They just flee the room. And it pushed me a number of years ago to meet with all of the religious leaders in the community in which I lived well in advance of Mother's Day, and share with them that although this felt like a wonderful recognition of mothers, mm-hmm. there are people in their congregation who are unable to have children and for whom that recognition is immensely painful. And all of them made discussions amongst themselves. Many of them got back in touch with me to say that they had changed that and had focused much more on family in general in their Mother's Day sermon rather than on mothers.
Let's talk with another listener here, someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, thank you very much for your discussion of adoption in particular. I just wanted to, on the one hand, make a note concerning adoption in the States. My wife is from overseas, and I can tell you that we recently adopted. And adoption is very much more looked askance upon in a variety of cultures. And so one thing I can say about the States is that fortunately, generally speaking, people are very, very supportive, and so we've been blessed in that regard. One thing I did want to note also, though, is that we tried through China for 5 years. I think 2005 was the window in which suddenly they become much more strict, and the levels of rules are utterly draconian. It includes, for example, your weight and so forth. And we applied and we waited for 5 years. And I wanted to make a plug for a domestic adoption because we finally gave up. And within a week of giving our, description of ourselves and so forth to an adoption agency in Chicago, we received a call. And so we ended up adopting, and we're very, very blessed and very happy about it. But it was so stressful waiting on China that I was about to the point where I couldn't recommend to anyone to consider adoption at this point because it's so difficult these days, international adoption. But I do think that people should still try it if they want to, but they should also consider the domestic approach. And we were very lucky, by the way. The agency said don't go around telling people that it happened in a week, but we were very, very lucky. But having gone through that, I can't even tell you how stressful, you can probably imagine, 5 years of waiting was, starting in our early 40s. So all's well that ends well, I suppose, in a sense. But the domestic side, I think people should really consider. I think there are a lot of wonderful children out there. As with any international adoption, you have to be very, very careful and, with your agency and so forth. But I just wanted to take note of that.
Great.
Well, I thank you very much for calling in. Your experience with international adoption is something that I think a number of people have probably echoed over the years. And certainly in this country, there are numbers of children who are waiting for adoption and numbers of expectant mothers who expect to make a plan for their child's adoption after it's born. So the opportunity to explore domestic adoption certainly exists. And I am very pleased that you've offered your personal experience with this.
Yeah,
Thank you.
About 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Our guest is Constance Shapiro. She is professor of family studies and social work at University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. She's a therapist, a university professor, consultant, does a lot of speaking and this on this particular subject. She's very interested in the study of infertility and its emotional impact on individuals and couples. And that is the subject of her book, When You're Not Expecting an Infertility Survival Guide. It's aimed at dealing with the emotional issues and helping people think about that and prepare for that and deal with that. And it's published by Wiley and is out now. Also, you can look at her blog, ConnieShapiro.com, and questions are welcome. We talked a little bit earlier about the effect that infertility can have on people's lovemaking. Mm-hmm. And about your suggesting that you don't want them to be constantly talking about infertility. That is, you just sort of want to say to narrow the times and the places where this is an acceptable topic of conversation. I guess I'm thinking about the again another one of the chapters in the book, The Waiting Game When Life Is on Hold, and thinking about again the issue when this is the center of life. It's the thing we're constantly thinking about and preparing for. I'm sure that so many other things do get put on hold because you say either right out or you have in the back of your head that other stuff just doesn't really matter right now because this is the most important thing right now. Well, you can't really live that way, but I'm sure that happens. I mean, how do you help people to try to think about their total life and everything that they need to be doing and thinking about and the place that the effort to become pregnant has in their total lives?
That's a complicated question because it depends on the couple and exactly what their circumstances are. But I do encourage them to think together of ways that they can get out away from the issues of infertility, whether this means that they take trips or vacations, and sometimes the cost of infertility means that those trips or vacations are at a campground 5 miles down the road. Mm-hmm. I also, as I've said, discourage them from talking nonstop about infertility. And I encourage them to pick up hobbies, to do volunteer activities that will put them in situations of recognizing that they can make contributions in many ways in their communities. And sometimes with the couple, there are issues of when they want to continue their education, whether they want to change jobs, which may involve a move from this community where they're getting their infertility treatment. So the issues are varied. And periodically, I introduce into the topic, what if you are not successful in conceiving? Mm-hmm. What do you see happening down the road? If I do this early, they say there's no way we're thinking about adoption. There's no way, you know, that we would not continue trying forever. But after a year or two, and I reintroduce the question, somehow there's more openness to the idea of either child-free living or adoption, or depending upon what's been discovered with regard to the woman's capacity to bear a child, the thought of a surrogate. So there are, I think, with any number of couples, ways in which they can take themselves out of the place of thinking and talking constantly about infertility, and also take themselves enough into the future to think about, do we really want to be having this conversation 2 years from now, or do we want to have shifted this conversation, both with our physician, whom we hope is going to take additional technology to help us, and with you, the counselor, where we want not to be continuing this conversation. And my encouragement to them is you need to look down the road as to where you're going, how some of the experiences you can have today will make you feel richer in terms of your friendship network, richer in terms of your family support network, and more contemplative about the extent to which having a child in your life is really as important as it is this very moment.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned something that I wonder how people think about, and that's the expense that's involved, because it's quite expensive. It can run into a lot of money.
Yes.
And I'm sure that that's an additional stressor if that's just the sheer expense is an issue for the couple.
Yes.
And I'm sure that that's also puts more pressure on it, because you say to yourself, hey, we're spending a lot of money here if it doesn't seem to be yielding results.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that that's also an awkward thing to that may be as awkward as talking about sex, talking about financial issues and how couples think about that. That can be a big problem in just, you know, in everyday routine relations between couples, how people think about where the money goes, how it's spent. So if this is a big issue, how do you get to people to talk about that?
Well, first of all, we may not be talking about couples who have very much money to start with. We may not be talking about couples who even have insurance. So there are low-income couples who are probably going to have a great amount of difficulty even paying for diagnostic tests. They are probably not going to have the resources financially to go to IVF clinics and to really look upon medical technology as possible. So with them, we really begin fairly early talking about foster care, talking about adoption, talking about ways in which they can bring children into their lives even if they are not able to conceive. For couples who do have insurance, sometimes their insurance will cover this, sometimes it won't. And for couples who are spending a lot of money beyond what their insurance covers, this is when I strongly encourage them to think about, how much more money do you have to spend on this? If you are going to be thinking about adoption down the road, you need to have a nest egg for adoption costs that you don't want to spend on IVF or other kinds of treatments. So I encourage them to go home to talk about it and to come back and talk with me. And then sometimes it's a matter of they're talking with their physician about how much longer they want to stay in treatment with the infertility specialist. That will sometimes move the infertility specialist into higher levels of technology than that person might have chosen to do, because he or she realizes that the couple is not going to be there for 5 years, that the couple has set a one-year deadline because of costs.
Yeah, I think that's I wonder whether people think about that, the long-term implications of spending the money, particularly if, as you say, that a certain point will come and maybe they're actually going to think about adoption. Well, that's also very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be sort of a shame if you had exhausted all of your resources and then you came to the point and said, well, maybe that this is the thing to do, and that then you don't have the money.
Exactly. And you know, David, one of the things we haven't yet talked about, and our time is growing short, is pregnancy loss. And pregnancy loss is an important component of any time that I talk about infertility, because couples, when they become pregnant, of course, are ecstatic. But because of the risks that may have prevented them from becoming pregnant, the possibility of losing a pregnancy also exists. So when I talk about infertility, I also do pay attention to the loss of a pregnancy. It may be an early miscarriage, or it may be as far along as a stillborn baby. But these are dimensions of loss that also are in the mix when we're thinking of infertility. And I have a chapter in my book called Achieving Pregnancy, an Emotional Roller Coaster, and also Pregnancy Loss, a Shattered Dream. So the balancing act that couples need to go through emotionally when they lose a pregnancy is also a component that I didn't want to leave this program without bringing.
Well, and I appreciate that. And I hope that people certainly will look at the book when you're not expecting, because it will go into the things that we're talking about in greater depth. And as you say, I think what you've tried to do is have people that you have worked with as in counseling present their voices. So this is people, it's not just you as a counselor talking, it's people who have had the experience talking and talking about what it's like. So I would certainly encourage people to look at it. And as you say, we have a couple of minutes left. And I guess that one thing that I also want to touch on, which is a major section of the book, is how do you help people think about the question of when does the time come when you say, okay, we're done. We can't keep doing this. We're going to have to stop. You know, either you've spending a lot of money, or you've just been trying and there just doesn't really seem to be a good reason to continue. But I'm sure that for a lot of people, you know, your head tells you that it's time to stop, but emotionally, to be able to say, to close that door is very difficult.
Yes, it is difficult. It's something that I raise periodically in my sessions with couples, and the book itself will also periodically raise the question of how people are moving through this infertility journey that starts with wondering, why can't I become pregnant, that goes through all of the medical treatments. Many of these medical treatments have mood swings as a part of them, and certainly there is a toll on the marriage. So I will say that periodically I say to a couple, what is really important in your lives right now? Are you finding that this struggle to become pregnant is what you want to focus on for interminable number of years, or can you begin to see an age at which you really are prepared to draw some closure? And we have it as a part of our conversation, and I keep coming back to it. I keep saying, where are you now emotionally? Are you feeling as if you're getting closer to thinking about child-free living, to thinking about how your relationship with your partner has been so wonderful for so many years and how infertility has interrupted that? So it's not an all of a sudden, hey, you all need to think about stopping this. Mm-hmm. It is, are we at a place now, after all of the many counseling sessions that we've had, where you're beginning to be grateful for the relationship that is held together during this difficult time? And can you look at child-free living in a way that's different than you did in the early months of our meeting?
Yeah. Well, there, we're going to have to stop. The book is When You're Not Expecting, an Infertility Survival Guide. And it's published by Wiley. You should be able to find it in the bookstore or perhaps in the library, by our guest, Constance Shapiro. She is a professor of family studies and social work at U of I Urbana-Champaign. And you might want to take a look at her blog, ConnieShapiro.com. What sort of things would people find there?
They'll find everything. They will find experiences that I've recently had with individuals and issues in the news that are related to infertility. So every week there's something new.
All right. Thanks very much for being here.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first broadcast the show on August 24th. We'll take a break here, and when we come back in the next hour, a conversation that Celeste Quinn had back also in August with the author of the book, The 24-Hour Mind. It's about what happens in our brains when we sleep.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
Up
today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, where visitors of all ages can uncover and discover the wonderment of America's musical past through guided tours Monday through Friday at the University of Illinois. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
Up next, an update on the markets.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. Let's go right on out to Kansas City and Chicago. Kansas City December wheat is now trading at 719.5, up 8 March.